Good morning, everyone. Call to order the February 11th, 2014 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Good morning to everyone. We have a couple of bills here this morning, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4075. And Beth, can you tell us briefly a little bit about that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4075 would authorize a person with a disability who is lawfully hunting to use battery-powered scoping devices, laser sighting devices on a bow or firearm, or a pin sight light on a bow. It also allows a person to accompany that person with a disability to assist with hunting. There's a Dash 1 amendment in the packet in front of you.
All right. Thank you very much. And, folks, I want to let everyone know that this bill there is an amendment to this bill. So I've heard a fair amount from the public on this. So with that, I'd like to call forward, please, Representative Jensen. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. Good morning. Thank you for being here to hear this bill and enter into deliberation, hopefully on it. This bill comes to me via a constituent. Has a little bit of background. The reason that there was a misdrafting of the previous or of the original bill was that the LC was given direction that there was a bill from last session or a LC from last session and to just copy that. I erred in that, because that was not the bill I had in mind. And when I discovered that error, I went back and asked Elsie to redraft the bill or rewrite the bill and do the proverbial gut and stomach of my own bill to get the thing that we were specifically looking for. At any rate, I want to, and I hope the chair will indulge me and allow me to read the testimony, and I know you have a copy of it, and I know you all can read, but I would still like to read it into
please,
the record
please
with
do.
Your permission.
Please do.
Okay. Dear Mr. Jensen, thank you for taking the time to read this letter so that others may hear my side of the story. I started hunting when I was 10 years old and have always been involved in the wilderness and outdoors with so many of my hobbies. It has been a very important part of my family and me to use the outdoors. This has been a long-standing tradition that I had until my vision was lost during the Iraq tour in 2007 and 2008, through no fault of his own. After losing my vision, I found that I lost all the hobbies that I had enjoyed before. Trying to find a way to continue hunting, I read about other states that allowed visually impaired people to use lasers to hunt alongside other people in tree stands or hunting blinds. I tried contacting the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to get an exception to the no laser rule. After several attempts to try and reach the correct person in charge, I finally reached a lady that told me hunting was not a sport, recreation, or hobby. She stated that the only reason that the fish and game allows hunting is to put meat on the table. Since this is the fish and game's goal, she told me that I could apply for a disability hunting tag that would allow someone else to shoot the animal for me. She brought up to me that a laser subject had been addressed before by others and it had been turned down because there is no need to change the policy when they're already allowed someone else to shoot the animal for them. I then contacted my NRA representative or spokesperson, and he recommended I speak to Representative Jensen to help me change the law so that blind or visually impaired people might be able to enjoy hunting as a sport, recreation, or hobby. There are other regulations in fish and game that limit the handicapped. I'm unable to hunt during bow season because I cannot hold the bow aimed and hit a target. If crossbows were allowed, I would be able to use a laser and hunt the same as any other bow hunter. There are many more areas that I believe the Fish and Game could change to enable handicapped people to be able to hunt and fish easier. My main objective now is to be able to allow lasers so that I might be able to rifle hunt again. People who are not visually impaired do not understand that losing your vision takes away all your freedoms as it is. Simple tasks are no longer done by yourself, which makes it demoralizing as it is just to live. I see no reason that Fish and Game cannot try and accommodate visually impaired and handicapped people so that they might be able to live a longer, more enjoyable life. This change is liable to only affect a very few amount of hunters and will not increase their chances of success, but give them the freedom to succeed at something that they enjoy. Please take into consideration what you're able to enjoy every day with your eyesight and how limited visually impaired people are in their daily living, let alone hobbies that they once enjoyed. I hope that in the future, handicapped people will not have to go through this lengthy process to be able to do what others have the opportunity to do every day. Thank you again for your time, James Rayburn. And Mr. Rayburn is from the LeGrand area. One of the portions of the bill that I had difficulty with was in a section that has to do with the age that there's a provision that the visually impaired person must have an aide or somebody there to assist them. And the age limit of that was something I had some difficulty with. But I went back and remembered. I am the father of four, and I have two boys, and hunting season, when those boys reached the age of hunting, and I was living in Montana at the time, and it was 12 years of age then, but for the oldest one, hunting became, if you wish, as far as family was concerned, a real father-son bonding. And I am sorry that ODF&W's representative referred to it as a not a sport or a recreation, but simply as meat hunting. And I admit that there are many people that would suffer protein deficiencies were it not for their ability to hunt. But most of us, at least many of us who hunt, do so for recreational purposes. I think my son was better off bonding with me over the hunting issue than not bonding with me and getting into the, at that time, illegal marijuana or heroin or et cetera type of thing. So I I labored over that and finally decided on the go with the age 12, which is the legal age, because it would give father and son an opportunity to do the same things that I was able to do with my sons when they were growing up. This is a bill which for a very limited number of people sets aside the administrative rules that exist now prohibiting the use of this type of sighting device, pure and simple, for a select and a very select group of people. And in this case, for a young man who went into harm's way and came home unable to do the things that he did when he went to Iraq. So I respectfully ask your consideration of this bill, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very, very much, Representative. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Since I'm not really familiar, how does a laser make someone who is blind or legally blind, how does that help them? I know it would put a point on the animal, is that right? So yeah, the person can see well enough to see that he's shooting an elk, not a horse.
And that would be the purpose, the major purpose of having an aide or somebody there to ensure that the aim was well placed, and B, that the animal was one that the person is actually hunting.
So can they see that laser dot on the animal then? The person can see well enough to see what he's looking at, but he can see the dot clear over there?
No, I think well enough. And I think that probably varies, and I wouldn't be, it would vary from hunter to hunter, I think. I wouldn't be any kind of an authority on that. I would admit and recognize that technology in the hands of a bona fide marksman gives them incredible accuracy in shooting. I appreciate that. That's very true. Which maybe isn't all that bad a thing, since it may result in less wounded animals.
Representative Krieger.
Well, there's, including you and us sitting up here, I think there's seven people wearing glasses and eight or nine in the audience.
The combination
of visually impaired.
Me too.
We understand. How do we understand what that? Who's that all encompass? Am I visually impaired then because I wear glasses?
That would be the intention of the bill. Those that would qualify for this would be those who are defined to be legally blind.
Didn't say that.
So the if I might, the. The bill defines visual impairment as someone whose central visual acuity does not exceed 20/200. So that's the definition. And
yeah.
And
I think that's the definition of legally blind, isn't it?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Reardon?
Thank you. I had the same question about the how you define the degree of impairment. And so do they hand that doctor's note in when they buy their license, or how does that work?
Do you know, Representative?
They would have to have established through some type of testing, whether it's a doctor's office or...
It says that they, again, that... visual acuity be filed with as proof with the with the commission, meaning the Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry I missed the beginning of your comments, Representative, but I believe we talked about this a little bit in the hall, and there was a constituent who sort of alerted you to his interest. So this is going to sound just a little bit strange, but I just need to ask for the record, because I've had some email traffic. This isn't designed to be a backdoor attempt to allow cougar and bear hunting and night scopes for other hunters, is it?
I wish I were clever enough to find a good backdoor attempt to do that, but I'm sorry I'm not.
And, okay. That's what I thought.
We need to think about this a little bit.
Yeah. Let's see if we can manipulate.
Give me an idea. I'll spend the rest of the session thinking about amending something to do that. Thank you, Representative Clem, for the questions, and no, it does not.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I know this sounds very strange, but would there be a way of limiting this to people whose eyesight was impaired due to accidents, not, I don't want to pick on anybody, but a diabetic whose eyesight goes away, you know, like just soldiers only? Or, I mean, I think it is a lot more palatable if it's limited to someone who,
lost their vision in the service of their country. Is that what you're saying, Representative?
Yeah.
Yes.
Representative Whitt and Chair Whitt, I would certainly, if it were the pleasure of the committee to limit it to service-connected disabilities, I would not argue with the committee on that. I would point out that right now, and I think the agency is here and they'll tell you that the numbers are very small as it exists, and would not be all that big. I don't know if the disability is caused by a drunk driver running into somebody in an accident, that I would want to exclude them from, that's certainly the discretion of the committee, and I would be willing to entertain whatever thoughts the committee would have on that type of thing.
Thank you. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you. Representative, on the vision part of the 2200, my vision is 2100 correctable to 2020. Should we have a stipulation in there that it can't be corrected?
Non-correctable.
Is that what it says?
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, though. No, I understand.
Because that means I'm pretty close to being eligible, and I can see fine.
Yeah, again, I think by definition, if I may interrupt, the bill specifies that if it were correctable up to 2200.
So it's got to be worse than 2200, but correctable no better than 2200.
Correct.
Okay, I get that.
Chair Whitt, that was my intention that I asked.
So I can't use a laser? Is that what you're saying, Representative?
I don't think.
Okay.
I don't
just
think
wanted
I
to
would.
Check.
Chair Whitt, accepting the representative from Medford, if he needed a laser.
Well, Representative Jensen, I can give a first-hand account that he, in fact, probably does need one.
Yeah.
So.
we have been hunting together.
This is great to the doubt.
Right.
Additional questions or comments? Representative Jensen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Chair Whitt, and thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate your deliberation on this bill and hope that you can bring it to the floor.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to call forward I'm going to ask to come forward, please, Al Elkins. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Jensen and his office for getting us the amendment for last evening for us to review. We greatly appreciate that. We understand the situation the gentleman is in that would like to hunt, and over the years, OHA, Oregon Hunters Association, has been very active in working with those that need special assistance to hunt, and we appreciate the opportunity to do so in the past, and will continue to do so. This bill, however, has raised a number of issues from our group and from our board, and one the main concern is the high-tech laser this and scope laser that. And what has been brought to my attention is the issue of fair chase in relation to the high tech, but also the word abundance in terms of wildlife in the state of Oregon and whether we have the wildlife that can support high tech usage. Now, I understand the amendment narrows the definition, and over the years, I have been involved in two committees set up by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to look at disability permits and how they're issued. And what we have found in the past is that no matter how tight you write a definition, it becomes more relaxed and more people are eligible for it for a number of reasons, including the example of the doctor's signature this morning that was given. So that is a concern of ours as well, is that this is the nose under the camel's nose under the tent, and we are concerned about that in relation to the high tech, in relation to the definition. The other person usage is something that has also been a concern and brought up to our attention. So I just wanted to share that with the committee. If I, for a moment, could speak not to the bill, Mr. Chair, but to some high-tech issues. The Oregon Hunters Association Board of Directors is going to be bringing forth some concepts to this committee during the interim. We want to look at the how to deal with the usage of drones in relation to hunting. We also are seeing more and more requests and more availability of what they call nano GS chips that are allowed on some arrows, that once the animal is hit with that arrow, it's a tracking device that allows the person to use a handheld GS to track the animal after it is hit. We want to talk to the committee about that. And there is also some talk, I don't know how this works exactly, about placing those GS chips in some animals in the spring so that they're able to track them in the fall when they're hunting. I don't know how that works, but at a meeting in Arizona, a wildlife biologist brought that up to one of our members, and we just like to get a foothold on some of this technology before we're having to deal with it in a knee-jerk reaction. And so I will be bringing forth some concepts from the board to perhaps have the committee look at in relation to legislation dealing with those issues. That concludes my testimony. We'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Committee members, anyone have anything for Mr. Elkins? Al, I have to be very candid. This bill bothers me.
That does us too.
And I'm just very concerned about some of the precedents it may establish. Very concerned about an overuse of high-tech instruments. I'm very concerned about the implications on fair chase. And I'm also concerned that this may incent some people to go and recruit a disabled person in order to be able to fill a second or more tags. I'm terribly concerned about those kinds of negative incentives, potential negative incentives. I'm not saying that it's automatic, but I think we have to admit that there may be those who would take advantage of that kind of situation. I'm also concerned about what this does to the sport of hunting, and I recognize that there are a number of people who go hunting, and in fact I have done it myself, who have hunted for meat. But I don't consider that meat. I consider that a heck of a lot of work.
Right.
If I'm going out and packing animals out of the woods, that is a lot of work. If I'm interested as a hunter in the sport of hunting and enjoying the experience of hunting, is there not the capability for someone who is sight disabled to accompany someone else and enjoy that experience in someone else's company without the introduction of technological devices or the killing of a second animal by someone who's perhaps already filled a tag? This all troubles me greatly.
Mr. Chair, you've outlined very eloquently all the concerns that I've heard from our group when this bill was first introduced. I had a number of phone calls basically saying it takes, what you just said, takes away from the traditional experience of hunting. In relation to your last statement, when I first started with this group, one of my first bills, well, the first bill that I dealt with was the blind hunter bill, which has allowed a companion to work with the person and help the person retrieve the animal and track the animal. So I believe that's still on the books and that's still out there. People are able to do that.
Thank you. Committee members, anything further? Yes, Representative Thompson.
Do you know if any other states have laws similar to this? Has there been any experience?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I'm not well versed on what other states do in relation to this. Is that you?
Follow up,
please.
I share Sherwood's concern. I'm also wondering if this doesn't cross a boundary. It's a bit discriminatory, because if we provide this for people who are vision impaired, what about people that are physically impaired? Would allow them to take longer shots and a lot of the other issues. And I'm not sure that this, I understand accommodations for disabled people that augments their condition. It gives them more normal life. I'm not sure that this does this. It's kind of almost beyond that to allow them to do something that we wouldn't allow you or I to do.
Right.
And I'm just...
Chair Whitt,
this thing needs more study.
Representative Thompson, those are some of our concerns as well. And on these groups that I've worked on the disability work with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, we have found that the definitions are expanded because of the examples that you just brought up.
Yeah. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Al, I'm assuming that, which may be a bad thing to do, but I'm assuming that we're talking about a laser beam similar to what you have in a pistol. Something of that nature. Wouldn't be very large, be a small one. I'm wondering, I have 2100 vision, and I'm not sure I could see that at 100 yards with 2100 visions. How would someone at 2200 vision, I guess what I'm getting at is, why would we have that if you couldn't see it in the first place?
I have no answer.
I mean, is there a, do we know whether people can see that at 100 yards?
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, I have not seen the studies on that. I understand there is some data out there, but I absolutely have not looked at it. So
I couldn't see it.
Possibly some safety concerns involved here as well. Representative Whitsitt.
That's what I was trying to get at with with my question. Is there something when they sight it on that it tells them to shoot then? I mean, is there some sort of a device that's set up with that clicks on and says, like, you've got it where you want it? Or I don't see how you can see a laser light that far away. I can't see it that far away.
Chair Witt, Representative Witt, I have never seen one of those in use, so I don't.
Thank you very much. Anything more, committee members? Yes, Representative Thompson.
It just seems to me it would be prudent on this bill to hold it off for maybe next session, and there's just too many questions that may or may not have answers. But and I share what I sense some of the other people are asking about. If you can't see, why would you be able to see a laser spot? And now that may be a perfectly good answer to that. I don't have it, but I'd like to know the answer to that before we went forward with something like this.
Very good point. Representative Reardon?
Well, even if I can see the spot, can I see what the spot is on?
In relationship.
So what that object is that the spot is on. So I just want to commend this committee. You guys thought of all kinds of things that I would never have thought of, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. With that, Al?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I would worry that the spot might be on you or me.
I'd like to call up next, please, Craig Starr and Roger Beyer. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Craig Starr. I reside at 2105 Desiree Place in Lebanon, and I'm an officer with Oregon Bow Hunters. I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 4075. OBH is taking a neutral position as far as the merits that are addressed, merits of the issue that are being addressed by this bill. I will say that the amendments that have been proposed address most of the major concerns that we had about the original drafting of the bill. OBH understands and supports the interest in providing and enhancing hunting opportunities for persons with disabilities, so long as doing so doesn't have the capacity to destroy the opportunities for everyone. And we don't think House Bill 4075 has that capability. There are only a couple of things that I would comment regarding the language in the amendments. As somebody who knows absolutely nothing about your role in drafting legislation and so on, but as someone who occasionally looks something up in the statutes, I think the proposed language regarding the specific equipment would be better placed in 498.170 rather than 498.142, because if I'm looking for something having to do with visually disabled individuals, I'm going to go to 170, and I wouldn't probably even think to look at 142. And the other thing is, I think the types of equipment that are discussed in the bill really need specific definitions included in the law. A laser sighting device, number one, I don't know what they are, and I've hunted with rifle, muzzleloader, and bow for over 50 years here in Oregon, and so not knowing what something is a concern, and I know we would have a concern about any device that would project a light or a beam that puts a target on the animal. If it's internal to the piece of equipment or something, it's less of a concern. But projecting that beam, one of the major problems, of course, is that the use of a beam like that would open up shooting prior to and after legal shooting hours, and of course poaching in the middle of the night. So that would be a major concern we would have. But other than that, we take no position opposed or supporting the bill as proposed amendments would have it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Starr. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the National Rifle Association and the Oregon members of the association. The National Rifle Association supports enhanced hunting opportunities for people with disabilities and people with sight disabilities. And we come forward to make comments on House Bill 4075-1. Appreciate the amendments. They much improved the original bill. The original bill, we felt, did not accomplish, you know, the goal of what Representative Jensen wanted, as he submitted. The amendments are much improved. At the same time, there could be some problems with amendments. I think you've just heard about some of the definitions that maybe need to be tightened up. I'd like to comment on a couple of questions that the committee seemed to pose that I think the concept is, under current law, the sight impaired person has a person with them that can shoot the animal for the person. That is how it works today, because a sight impaired person, when they can't look through or see through a scope or a bow and you know, see the animal and be able to shoot the target. Under the concept, I believe, behind this bill is that the sight impaired person would be holding the bow or the rifle. The dot projects in the case of a laser dot to the target, and the person's companion will then tell the person when it's time to fire the weapon, pull the trigger, release the bow. That is the difference between what this is proposing to do versus what today's law is. So I think that's some of the questions you had about how would the person see the laser dot. It's the person's companion that sees the laser dot, but the person who is holding the weapon would actually pull the trigger or release the bowstring. So that is somewhat how it was different than today's, what is currently in statute today. The issue of disability and whether or not 2200 is the correct amount, I think all that needs to maybe be looked at, tightened. So just want to put on the record, the NRDA does support the goal of more hunting opportunities for physically impaired people, both vision and other disabilities, but might have some current concerns with this language as it is.
Thank you very much. Committee members, anyone have anything? Gentlemen, thank you both very, very much. Appreciate your appearance.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to call up, please, Rich Thompson.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, welcome. I am with the Traditional Archers of Oregon. We're the guys with longbows and recurves.
Okay.
So any advancements that we see coming in the way of technology raises a red flag for us naturally. I was glad to see that bill had been reconsidered.
If I could interrupt just for a moment. If you would please just formally introduce yourself, give us your name for the record. Thank you.
I should know better than that. Thank you. My name is Rich Thompson. I live in Newburgh, Oregon, and I'm the president of the Traditional Archers of Oregon.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt your testimony.
No problem. Anyway, the bill had some concerns, and I had initially drafted a response to it, and then I got the note last night that the bill had been amended, and so I just kind of wanted to focus on what we saw. My previous testimony as I said, anything with sighting devices or electronics, improved technology creates a red flag for members of the traditional archers of Oregon. And we feel that legalizing them will take our archery seasons someplace where they're not intended to go when they were created way back when. The growing population of disabled people is also a concern. You probably see things on the evening news, read them in the paper about the growing number, what they're doing to the government coffers all the way around because there's getting to be so many people claiming disabilities. How is that being controlled? It doesn't seem like it is to a lot of people. What these, and I think Al brought up what some of these changes and allowing increased technology will do to our game populations. And here in Oregon, we don't have a lot of deer. The states where a lot of these things have become legal over time, they've got more deer than they know what to do with. I just talked to a friend in Michigan. He had shot his fifth deer in Michigan. That's only a dream here in Oregon to be able to shoot five deer. Some of the concerns on the amendment I've listed out, and I believe you all have a copy of that now, but it appears as though the bow side of this has been dropped, and I don't know what that means in terms of rifles, but it apparently no longer applies basically to archers for selecting, sighting, and advising the visually impaired person. And I question, and Representative Jensen brought it up, said he thought long and hard about a 12-year-old guiding someone else on when to shoot. As a hunter ed instructor, this is a critical component of what young hunters are taught. But at 12 years old, I'm not real sure that that person may have the experience to do that. It does say that the person the companion, cannot have a visual impairment. That's very important, as I think Representative Whitsitt was pointing out. And finally, it's one thing. It says in there that the hunter or the person accompanying the hunter can shoot a game animal for the person. Can that person use the hunter's weapon? The one with all the gadgets on it. It doesn't clarify that. In other words, give me your gun or a bow or whatever it is. And then that idea, that notion of having somebody else shoot your animal for you, as I say in my testimony, both of them, this is just basically wrong and unethical in my opinion, and I can't believe any true sportsman would, you know, say, here, shoot my animal for me. And I'd also like to leave you with the thought that basically making these rules for a lot of these hunting things in the here in the Capitol rather than at ODFW headquarters, I think just basically circumvents the rulemaking authority that they have. And I haven't heard anybody testify today from ODFW, and I was wondering about that. I believe that's about all I have, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Thompson? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify today on House Bill 4075? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4075, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4139. Beth, could you tell us about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4139 has a -2 amendment, which should be in front of you. The amendment would replace the original measure and direct Oregon State University in consultation with the Oregon Department of Agriculture to develop educational materials on best practices to avoid adverse effects on pollinators. The amendment describes those educational materials. It would also require ODA to make those materials part of the education requirement for pesticide applicator license examinations. The Dash 2 creates a task force on pollinator health, which would be comprised of 10 members, and directs that task force to submit a report to an interim legislative committee no later than October 1, 2014.
Thank you very much. I think Representative Reardon is going to present the bill.
Good morning, Chair Witt.
Good morning.
And esteemed committee. I want to remind you before I get into my prepared remarks, which I will read in just a moment, that this bill is drastically different than what was there yesterday morning. So if you haven't looked at the current bill, please take a moment to do that. What we've developed is a very straightforward, common sense bill that will help us find a balance between the use of pesticides and the need to help protect the creatures we depend on to pollinate a wide variety of plants, including the plants that provide about 35% of our own food. Neonicotinoids were made available in the mid-1990s, offering a long-term plant protection from sap-sucking insects and touted as being safer for birds and wildlife than earlier insecticides. Six neonicotinoids are found in hundreds of plant protection products found on the shelves of agricultural supply stores and garden centers. But over time, we've learned that just as powerful automobiles in the hands of an untrained or inattentive driver can easily kill or injure people, powerful chemicals such as neonicotinoids in the hands of an uninformed, inexperienced applicator can kill bees, in this case in the tens of thousands. As you may know, the Department of Ag does require training and licensing for those who apply restricted-use pesticides or who apply any general-use pesticide to someone else's property. In response to last summer's bee kill-offs in Wilsonville, Hillsboro, and two other locations, that program is actually being improved to include information about neonicotinoids and their effects on pollinators. As a result of the department's work in collaboration with Oregon State University, licensed applicators will soon become, or are becoming, better prepared to use these chemicals. But here's the problem. Home gardeners and other users, such as nursery workers, can go to the farm or garden store and purchase pesticides containing neonicotinoids for use on their veggies and ornamental plants. The home gardeners and other users are not required to complete training or demonstrate their knowledge in any way. They're expected to read and follow the directions on the label without fail. And there's no way to be sure that home gardeners and other users have read or comprehend the labels. Actually, the labels may not even be in their own language. There's no requirements to keep application records, which makes it easy to apply the products repeatedly. Given the extremely long persistence, and it's important to understand, this stuff can stay in the ground or in a plant for 6 to 7 years. It'd be very easy to over-apply the chemicals. Most Oregonians, and certainly our agricultural community, care deeply about their state and the environment. I believe that Oregonians are willing to take the steps to help ensure that we can protect the pollinators that are critical to food production for both humans and wildlife. But we must find better ways to ensure people are informed and understand before they begin using these chemicals. So I started with the idea that four of the neonicotinoids should be put on the restricted use list, making them available only to licensed applicators. Since the bill's original introduction, my staff and I have worked diligently with several stakeholders to develop different solutions. The stakeholders joined together, and I would like to acknowledge them today. We've had great support from the Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, Beyond Toxics, the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, the Xerces Society, and the Oregon Nursery Association, and the Farm Bureau. As you can see, the stakeholders represented groups that were able to contribute in a variety of ways, and thank you to all of them. I'm pleased to introduce a bill that creates a task force to help us develop solutions that could appear in legislation next session, or maybe not. Members would include one senator and one rep from different parties, non-voting, and we would be non-voting members. There would be a university researcher who specializes in pollinator health, advocates representing greenhouse producers, farmers, pollinators, retailers, and the environment, and a master gardener and a beekeeper representing the public. Simply, we would study what other states and regions are doing to protect pollinators, whether that is additional regulation, public education, best management practices for applicators, legal requirements, or incentives. The task force will submit a report and may recommend legislation at the end of this year. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for our committee colleague? Representative Reardon, I just want to I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. You've garnered a very significant amount of public attention on this bill, and I personally can think of no better way than hastening the demise of the good Mother Earth than to eliminate the pollinators. So it is a critically important subject. On the other hand, I am I commend you for not undertaking a rush to judgment, if you will, and taking a very measured approach that considers the best practices and how we can best deal with these situations. And I think that you've handled this situation in a statesman-like fashion, and I thank you ever so much for this approach. Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Thank you very much.
I wish Clem were here, that trying to keep his pairs going. So.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Jeff Stone and Katie Fast.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The issue of pollinator health is an important one for both beekeepers and farmers. Oregon farmers rely on honeybees and native pollinators to pollinate a multitude of crops. And actually, in 2007, I chaired a bee health committee for Oregon State University that brought together a honeybee and farm interest to discuss this very issue. Out of that work group actually came legislative action to create a bee specialist position at Oregon State that continues to this day. Today, though, both industry sectors are very concerned with the highly publicized Wilsonville bee kill that happened this summer. Oregon Farm Bureau, though, is pleased with Oregon Department of Agriculture's serious response to this situation. Not only did the department do a thorough investigation that resulted in civil penalties, they have convened a pollinator work group to discuss issues surrounding pollinator health. Also, by rule, ODA has prohibited the use of two of the active ingredients that are listed in this legislation, and prevented them to be applied on linden, basswood, or tilia species of trees. Both these responses are appropriate to address bee deaths that happened this summer and to prevent future incidents. Oregon Farm Bureau opposes the original draft of House Bill 4139, which would be the first time Oregon's legislature restricted the use of a chemical instead of relying on the expertise and science at EPA and ODA. This is an unnecessary precedent for Oregon's pesticide registrations, and additionally, these chemicals are commonly used in nursery operations, which many do not have a pesticide applicator's license. This legislation will remove a safe and efficient product from these farmers. Farm Bureau can support a work group that's lined out in the Dash 2 amendments and an educational program developed by Oregon State University. However, we still have concerns in the Dash 2 amendments regarding the work group having a directed outcome with legislation. We do not believe that this is the best solution. The work group should decide and make recommendations that they think is appropriate to address the issues. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. You can imagine my surprise when the BDS were announced. It was less than a mile from OAN headquarters by one of my members on National Pollinator Day. So it was a confluence of issues that, if you could see my file on this, it's now well over 3 inches thick and double-sided. So that's really awesome. Not so much, actually. It's no laughing matter that we take the health of pollinators very seriously. We had Carson Lord, my president at the time, come before this committee last November to talk about trade-offs. And I think that the good representative, Reardon, has put together a very balanced approach about how do we get at some of the core issues, look at what the true causes are of colony collapse. Because Ms. Fass is right, farmers, nurserymen, home gardeners all have a role to play on pollinator health. I'd remind this committee, though, that the applicator had a license. So what we're trying to do is make sure that the industry understands the pros and cons of using certain types of pesticides on certain kinds of trees. Linden trees are an attractor for bees. I read the label myself, and I'm not a pesticide applicator, but I even knew that you should not be spraying on these trees. However, I think that the approach that Representative Reardon has pursued is fair. I think we could have easily gone into various camps on this because everybody cares, right? So I would suggest that this study group proceed. I would urge the Dash 2 amendments. And I agree with Ms. Fass that if legislation is needed, let the process dictate that. But we will stand to be a reasoned voice on this debate, and I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Anything? Yes, Representative Whitson.
I was just wondering, and I don't know the answer to this, but is English as a second language an issue for the applicators? Is it listed on the containers in Spanish what you can and can't put on, like you're talking about the linden trees?
Madam Chair, I wasn't in attention. I was looking back at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I do not recall, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitson, if they are in Spanish. The EPA, though, when they're looking at the new labels, are going to have a bee insignia to try to get beyond some of the language barriers that we might find. But I don't know about you, but I have a bunch of things in my garage that I probably should have thrown away safely, on the record. But I'm the guy who does, if a little bit of Roundup works on my weeds, a lot of it will work even better. So we need to have education on a number of fronts. And so how we do that with a label would be very critical. Thank you.
Yeah, if I could just add, Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, one item that Jeff kind of alluded to is EPA is looking at these group of pesticides, neonicotinoids, and for 2014 has come out with a new label that really focuses around pollinators and has some visual aspects. And I think that's really not only to get at issues around, English as a second language, but also to homeowners who many times aren't as familiar with pesticide use as farmers are. And so try to really highlight that issue. These compounds are used heavily in just garden use. For your roses is probably maybe the most common place. Maybe some of you have used it.
Anything further? I want to thank you both very, very much for your testimony and, more importantly, for your engagement over this issue and for your willingness to work with Representative Reardon. We have to get this right, and very much appreciate your help in to that end. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd just like to add, Representative Reardon spent quite a bit of time in a work group with all of us, and it's very much appreciated.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Christy Split and Lisa Arkin. Good morning to both of you, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Hi there. Good morning. For the record, my name is Christy Split, and I'm here today representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. We support House Bill 4139. We support it as originally drafted, and we support the Dash 2 amendments. It's been very evident to us that our members care deeply about protecting our pollinators. Last summer, when there were several incidents, I believe four, but ODA's in the room, so I think that's correct, separate bee die-off incidents in Oregon related to the application three of the times on label of neonicotinoids on tilia species of trees, linden trees in particular. And this is something that, as far as we know, hasn't happened before. So something new and different and emergent is occurring here, which is why we felt a temporary pause button on the use of neonicotinoids by non-licensed applicators seemed wise. While we put that bill forward and supported it, we were really grateful that we wound up working with that long list of stakeholders, the Nurseries Association, the Farm Bureau, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, the grocers, Beyond Toxic, Circe Society, and Representative Reardon, in crafting a bill that we can all agree to instead, which is the Dash 2 amendments, although I'm hearing a little bit of concern with the Dash 2, so I didn't know that was coming. we'd support a I also just want to point out that while we would have supported that temporary designation of the four neonicotinoids as restricted use pesticides, when we generated that plan, we thought that that would work well for nursery men and women and for farmers who usually or most of the time licensed pesticide applicators. However, it turns out that's not necessarily the case. So we're interested in pursuing the task force, but we're still hanging on to that idea that maybe that indeed more regulation might be necessary given the changing nature of bee health and the reaction of bees and other pollinators to pesticides, given other issues around colony collapse disorder. I also just want to give some very special thanks to Representative Reardon. He, when the bee die-offs were happening last summer, gave us a call almost immediately and said this was something of deep, deep concern to him. Could we work together? And at the time, we had just sent an email to our members asking them to sign a petition that would ask store owners to voluntarily pull these products off the shelves until we figured out what was going on. And we had thousands of our members respond and sign that petition to store owners. And we sent those petitions out, and numerous store owners from Bandon to Portland, all over the state, decided to either pull those products from their shelves or put up more clear labeling. And we think that that sort of development was just really significant and led to our decision to work on a bill together that would have done that across the board. So I just think the context is interesting, and that we did have such a strong level of support from so many store owners around the state. You would think that several thousand people signing a petition, you hear all the time these petitions don't make a difference, but we feel like people's activism really has made a difference on this issue. And I also want to thank the ODA. They did a wonderful job of doing a thorough investigation, and they're still continuing to urge EPA to be bolder and have stronger labeling and better labeling. As I mentioned, three of the incidents at least, and I feel like it might be four out of five, and I'm sorry if I'm getting it wrong on the record. That's really embarrassing. But that three out of the four incidents involved on-label pesticide application. And so getting those labels changed so that that doesn't happen again means so much. And the fact that ODA is working with EPA to make changes that affect the whole nation, I think, is really important. So I just want to say thank you to them, too.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the House Agriculture Natural Resources Committee. I'm Lisa Arkin, Executive Director of Beyond Toxics. Thank you all for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 4139, an act to protect Oregon's pollinators. I want to express my sincere thanks to Representative Reardon for bringing this issue forward to the legislature and for working so diligently with a diverse group of stakeholders. Sorry. Oregon must act now to stave off bee kills. If we don't, we might face a situation like is currently happening in China. In China, the world's pear capital, it is the farmers and not the bees who carry out the pollination of the trees. It is costly and painstaking work that replaces bees from what was determined to be bee die-offs from pesticide exposure. Bees are simply absent there. Attached to my testimony, you'll see some recent photographs taken from orchards in China where bee pollen, pear blossoms were pollinated one by one at a rate of 30 or so trees per day. Such drastic measures would send Oregon's pear, apple, and plum businesses into a tailspin. House Bill 4139, as it was originally drafted, addresses the problem of the highly toxic class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids and their impacts to all kinds of pollinating species. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has already recognized that these pesticides have the potential to kill bees outright. They are to be commended for taking some action to restrict neonicotinoids from some blossoming trees commonly used in landscaping. So you might be thinking to yourself, doesn't the EPA label and ODA's extra precautions eliminate the risk to bees from the use of these products? So the answer is no, it does not. EPA labeling of a pesticide is based on acute toxicity of the active ingredient. The label does not protect against other known hazards, such as sublethal or slow accumulation of a pesticide in the nectar, the pollen, or actually in the hive itself. Tissue samples taken in New York after hundreds of thousands of honeybees perished showed significant levels of neonicotinoids in the bee tissue. But there's no way to know if that was because of an acute poisoning or a buildup of the pesticide in their system. Therefore, applying a pesticide according to the label is not the same as applying it safely. It simply means it is applying it legally. In fact, in the number of bee kills that have been discussed today here in Oregon, the neonicotinoid product was applied according to the label in many instances, and the applicator was not at fault. So thus, again, I commend this committee for taking up this issue. It's a complex one. House Bill 4139, as it was originally drafted, had two important outcomes. First, four neonicotinoid active ingredients would have been restricted to use only by trained and licensed applicators. And the reasons for this restriction are twofold. One, applications in nurseries, farms, and landscaping businesses could continue to be carried out as we research and learn more. And secondly, general consumers who are not trained and not licensed would not have access to these products. Research by the Xerxes Society found that in some cases, the EPA label allows the general consumer and general consumer products to use it at a rate as much as 120 times more than what a commercial applicator would use in industrial settings. Also, the restricted use status in Oregon would only take about 4 to 10 products off the shelves. There's plenty of other choices and alternatives. The second point of House Bill 4139 is to make sure that experts at Oregon State University and Department of Agriculture jointly develop trainings for alternatives to neonicotinoids and pesticides and pollinator safety training. The training remains an essential part of the Dash 2 amendments, including the requirement to pass the course to receive one's pesticide applicator license. I was part of a diverse group of folks who helped to craft the Dash 2 amendments, working hard with Representative Reardon. I support the proposed task force and its work toward a meaningful outcome that protects native and honeybees. Chair Witt and honorable members of this committee, we have at stake here the future viability of Oregon's agricultural industry and the reliability of our food systems. If we do not act very soon to protect bees, we risk over $600 million in agricultural economic benefits to our state. There are alternatives to neonicotinoids, but there are no alternatives to natural pollination of hundreds of acres of pears, apples, blueberries, strawberries, and many other commodity crops in Oregon. So in closing, I urge you to take immediate action to pass a bill that will protect our pollinating honeybees and native bees, protect the future of agriculture in this state, and the balance and viability of the natural environment. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for the panel? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
I know you like to really do your research. Do you know why they haven't reintroduced bees in China? Obviously, they would rather have bees pollinate the trees. And how long they've been, the bees have been gone. I'm trying to figure out what is still causing the collapse if they stopped using the pesticides and are having to do this by hand. Do we know why the bees, after they've reintroduced them, aren't coming back?
Thank you, Chair Witt and Representative Whitsitt. Thanks. I've spent 13 years as a professor, so it is my nature to do that. And I don't have the details about the situation in China. As we said, it's a complex issue, and bee colony collapse has more to do than just only pesticides. I think everyone recognizes that. And it's not always so easy to get information from China as well. So I don't know the answer to your question, but I would be happy to try to find out and send you the answers.
Anything else? Thank you both very, very much, and thank you as well for your willingness to work with Representative Reardon so that we can make it possible for our pollinators to do the very best job that they can for us.
Thanks.
Thanks so much. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Patricia Williams. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair Witt and Representative Reardon. I'm not a professional commentator on this, so I was just a member of the public. So my name is Patricia Williams, and I live here in Salem, Oregon. And I'm speaking in favor of the bill, although it's not the bill that I would have liked. I like the original. And what I'd like to say is that when I think about the bees, I remember the quote from the Jared Diamond book, you know, what was in the mind of the Easter Islanders when they chopped down that last tree? And I think that that's the fate that we're beginning to see in our oceans and on our lands with the bees, with the ocean acidification, you know, killing off the shellfish. We're gradually, ever so gradually, poisoning and causing our earth to deteriorate. Bees are very important, and I think everybody here has mentioned why exactly they are important. And I don't know about that question about China intrigued me that you asked, because I had thought about that many times. I don't have any knowledge, but when bees disappear, native, they can't just live on pear pollen alone. They have to have other flowers to populate. So if the bees die, then these flowers that depended on them also die off. So it'd be pretty hard to reintroduce the same environment. We don't know what we're losing. That's the important thing. I had a lot of remarks I meant to read, but I'll just skip them. But basically, the bees are not the only things. We're going to lose the monarch butterfly, because in the Midwest, they're applying pesticides that are greatly destroying that one step of the seven-year migration, I think, of the monarch butterfly. And, you know, these things are important for our livelihood. One member who came to testify here, I think from the Oregon Farm Bureau, mentioned that this would be the first time something like this has come up. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's the first or the second. The important thing is that we need to start doing something right now. Our earth is deteriorating around us. Pesticides need to be more closely monitored, more carefully used, but rarely if we can. We need to get back to a more organic farming that will keep all the environment that, as we know, the ecology, running the way it was when we humans inherited the Earth and have done so well in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Williams? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very, very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 4139? Not seeing anyone. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4139. And committee members, I think our meeting on Thursday is going to be relatively short. And so I'd like to get your feelings. I don't think that we have to start at 8 o'clock. I'm not opposed to it. But if there's a time that's more convenient, I'm willing to consider that as well. So
9 o'clock is more convenient.
8 a.m., 8:30, 9 o'clock?
9 o'clock is more convenient.
9 o'clock sound good to
well,
folks?
Well, you got
to
get up, boy.
I'll be up either way.
Does 9 o'clock work for everyone?
A little bit later if I start.
All right, sounds very good. Yeah. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
I'm sure we'll find something to entertain ourselves.
I'm not seeing or hearing anything. With that, I'll see you all at 9 a.m. on Thursday morning, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.